Tonight on Arena, Niamh Alger takes on the role of a film censor in her latest movie, and we cast a critical ear over new albums from The Killers, Nas and Jungle. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Niamh Alger is an Irish actor on the crest of a wave of great new releases. She stars in the Channel 4 drama Deceit, which starts tonight. And next weekend, her latest film, Censor, opens in cinemas. Censor is the debut feature film from director and screenwriter Prano Bailey Bond. And it's a love letter of sorts to the VHS video nasty horror classics of the past, when film censor Enid, played by Niamh Alger, discovers an eerie horror video that speaks directly to her sister's mysterious disappearance. She looks to unravel the puzzle behind the film and its enigmatic director. Delighted to say that Niamh Alger joins us on the programme this evening to tell us more about Censor. Niamh, you certainly weren't around in the 1980s to consume these films at that time, but I'm presuming that you had to watch your fair share of video nasties to get the background for Enid.
I sure did, yeah. Prano sent me a watch list of movies that I needed to watch before coming into the production. I was in Cape Town at the time on a project, so I spent my weekends watching video nasties and educating myself on that genre.
So did you feel you had missed something really important in the 1980s?
I suppose it's different, you know, coming out from a woman. You wouldn't be watching it like, you know, it's not exactly catered for women, if that makes sense.
And
it wouldn't exactly be my style of film.
Yeah, because it's interesting, the character that you're playing in Censor then. I thought this is a brilliant kind of setup and a brilliant background to the whole thing. Enid is herself a censor and would have to spend days on end watching these films and making decisions about what should stay and what should go. Should the film be banned? Should this little scene be cut? Very interesting type of character to have to look at. Why would somebody want a job like that?
It's interesting that myself and Prana, we discussed why is it that Enid has chosen this profession. And a lot of it goes down to the idea that she sees herself as someone who's trying to protect the public from seeing something that will traumatize them, or, you know, the idea that she's protecting them from seeing the content that they shouldn't see. So she herself is constantly censoring this, but also she's censoring herself all the time in the way in which she presents herself to someone, but also these repressed memories. You know, effectively, this is a woman who has experienced this childhood trauma of losing her sister in such a traumatic way that she herself has censored out that memory. So, you know, the idea that someone is a censor and that Enid sees herself as this kind of superhero in her own narrative, protecting the public.
Let's have a listen to a clip from early on, in fact, and this is you with another of the censors. I think Sanderson is basically kind of the boss of the group of censors of which Enid is one. And this is from the beginning of the film. And you're looking at a particular piece of work and you're deciding what scene should go and what scene should stay. And this is the conversation then that takes place between you as Enid and Nicholas Barnes as Sanderson.
I'm not still going over it.
Well, if we're passing it as an 18, it needs more cuts.
The decapitation?
Nope. No, the decapitation is ridiculous. It's the eye gouging. It's too realistic. Plus, I was trying to see who dragged her away.
Does it matter?
Oh, it would be nice if it had some clear retribution.
I appreciate you analysing this with such precision, Enid, but perhaps someone got out of the cautious side of bed this morning?
Oh, I'm just doing my job.
You're missing the intellectual layer.
Oh, come on, we
the
both
The heightened references take the edge off the more realistic violence. See it less as an eye gouging, more part of a grand tradition. It's no worse than the Cyclops in Homer. It's Gloucester in Lear. It's un chien andalou.
I've salvaged the tug of war with the intestines. Kept in most of the screwdriver stuff, and I've only trimmed the tiniest bit off the end of the genitals. But some things should be left to the imagination.
It's like rat brothel all over again.
No, I just want to get it right. Plus, you lost the argument the moment you brought Shakespeare into the room. We can't afford to make mistakes. I'm cutting it.
And that's Niamh Elgar as Enid in a scene there from the beginning of the film, Sansa, and Niamh speaking to me about the film this evening. When I saw you in this, the first thing that struck me was, that's a very different Niamh Elgar than the Niamh Elgar I know from The Virtues, say, or from Calm with Horses. You know, this is a very different performance. Enid is very tight. She's very closed in. As you say, she's self-censoring a lot of the time. Now, it changes as the narrative goes on. We'll get to that for sure. But that must have been part of the attraction to that it was initially, at any rate, a very different character from those I've seen you play in the past.
I'm so glad you see that. It's the idea of challenging yourself as an actor and taking on a role that, A, you haven't attempted before, but also a role that I suppose audience can't predict that you're going to do. And that for me is, that's the fun of acting. It's just embodying a different person, both physically. I'm quite an athletic person, but I always imagined Enid as someone who isn't physically strong and she's closed off and uptight. I like to think I'm not. And just to be given the opportunity to convey that and to really step outside of yourself is exciting.
Yeah, and I wondered, Niamh, did you actually speak to any censors? Because the kind of detail that Enid goes into in that clip we just heard, you know, about the specifics of what little bits of what scenes should be left and what bits should go and the arguments that would have to be made. Did you speak to somebody about that?
Yeah, I was given the opportunity to speak to Carl Tobolsky, who was a censor during that era. And it's just fascinating She shared some of the notes with me of things that she would have cut out of certain films. And, you know, it's so specific. Like, as you hear there in that clip, it's like why they have to justify the eye gouging and not something else. And it relates to this and this. If you don't show one thing, what does it allude to in the other? And it was just fascinating for me just listening to Prana, who is so, she was like this encyclopedia of video nasties, and she explains, you know, her research on it and the amount of work that she'd done on it. It's like, you know, Prana could release an entire thesis on the video nasties.
She made a very interesting point I saw at one stage in an interview about the idea, this is Prana who spoke about this, that one of the big no-nos, it was blood, but blood specifically on the breast of a woman, because that was thought that it might encourage men to go out and rape, or it might be given as an excuse for rape. Some of the thinking behind it was quite extraordinary.
Yeah, that was it. It was saying that blood on breast would entice males to go out and create, or to go out and cause harm to women. And you know, who decides these? Who has come up with this study? You know, it's, you know, why I loved playing a character like this is that, you know, I was not educated on video nasties. So I got the opportunity to go and research a lot of video nasties and also just censorship, because you always just imagine it's just a board. It's just a board that puts a certificate on a film and decides that's the person that's allowed to be viewed by people of that age. And, you know, Carol talked about how she was seen as like this headmaster of genre, like the film industry, someone who puts certain limitations on the creative limitation of a film.
For sure, yeah. It that whole idea of censorship is part of the discussion here, but the film does go to a very different place in the second half. But before we speak about the latter part of the film, let me talk about what you've been up to. You very delicately said, I just finished on a project in Cape Town. What project in Cape Town? I think this was something that you really wanted to do, and big hero of yours, I believe, Ridley Scott, yeah?
Yes, this is, I was returning for season 2 of Raised by Wolves from the creator of of Blade Runner and a few other movies that we might remember, like Alien and Thelma Louise, Ridley Scott. So, I've just returned back from Cape Town where we shot season two.
And working with Ridley Scott on a television project like that, obviously you're back for season two, so he liked you and you liked him for sure. But your career is moving in a way that most actors would dream about, I think, Niamh. Do you have a sense of that yourself?
I've been very lucky in the last 4 years that I've had very little downtime. And I think that is something to really be very proud of, and especially in the current situation that we're all in, and I'm very blessed. But I spend a lot of time working for free and, you know, doing a lot of, I worked very hard to get the position where I can, you know, sit back and not sit back. It's more just like, keep going, make hay while the sun shines.
Yeah. you're not sitting back at the moment, because you've also, the Guy Ritchie project, Wrath of Man, that's going to come to our, is that coming to our cinema screen soon as well?
Yes. And also a TV series I did with Tom Ford called Deceit.
Well, clearly lockdown meant nothing to you. You were busy. I'm sure there were all sorts of protocols that you had to follow on the various projects you were on, but you've been very busy throughout that entire period then.
Yeah, and Deceit, the TV series with Channel 4, was the first TV series to go back after the lockdown. So that was the guinea pig of figuring out how the new COVID protocols were going to affect filming. So it was brand new territory, and it just meant just readjusting and being patient. We got like an email from our amazing producer, Addo, just before we started filming. It was just the idea of just remembering that we've all just come out of something quite traumatic. And this is a brand new norm for everyone to readjust to, and just to be patient and kind to one another.
Yeah, good advice. Can you identify within all of that, you know, the Ridley Scott, the Guy Ritchie, Cam with Horses film I loved and spoke to yourself and Barry Keoghan about at the time. You were there with Cosmo Jarvis. The Virtues, the Shane Meadows television series in which you were amazing as well. With Stephen Graham was in that, you know, amazing actors that you've had the chance to work with. Can you identify a moment when it kind of, it shifted? Can you see one of those projects that was a moment when it all kind of, you knew, well, I won't be working for nothing from now, or things are changing in some way?
I think it was probably the response of what The Virtues did. Both, I've never kind of experienced where audiences had such a positive response to, and critics as well.
Yeah.
And I think Shane even texted me that. He was like, dude, I've never had a project where both the public and critics are giving it the thumbs up.
The incredible character that you played in The Virtues. She was, Stephen Graham's character was coming looking for a long lost family. He was coming to Ireland to search that out, and you end up kind of being related by marriage to his past family. That's kind of where it was. But she was a boxer, and she certainly she was certainly not repressed or holding anything back in the way that Enid had to do.
No. No, she says it how it is, you know. She says it as she sees it, and I love that about Dina. You know, you kind of know where you stand with her. I was coming home after the first workshopping the character with Shane, and I was walking through Soho in London, and I saw this statue, this like sculpture of this kid with boxing gloves on by this amazing artist called Scooney. And I took a photo of it. Me and Shane had been talking about how we were going to develop this character and how she was going to be introduced into the story, and we hadn't fully decided yet. And I sent him a picture and I said, I think I found Dina's inner child, because we just talked about her being fiery and flighty, and, you know, and he introduced that character literally with a punch and said that, you know, this is someone who, you know, boxing was probably a part of their past as a kid. And how amazing it would be to have a female character enter into a show like that. And then when the show came out, that artist sent me a message on Instagram and asked, could he send something to my agent's office? And I said, absolutely, yeah, sounds great. And I came home one day to this massive parcel that was wrapped in this duvet and had a note on it. It was just like, you know, to Niamh, I saw The Virtues, and it just reminded me of an artwork of mine. And it was that photo that I'd taken of that sculpture. And it was the most, I always feel like things happen for a reason, and when you put things out into the universe, they kind of come back. But that was that little girl, that bruiser statuette is in my house now. It was just mental.
That is amazing. I'd be a bit worried if somebody decided to send you a film on the basis of seeing you as Enid. Have a look at this video nasty. It made me think of your character.
We've had such an amazing artwork already of people, you know, done of the character, and it's so nice when people that, you know, it rubs off on people, and they take ownership of the characters, and that's the whole point, is that I no longer own those characters. That is that people get to take them and take from them what they want.
Well, listen, Niamh, lovely to speak with you. Continued success on whatever it is you go to next. Looking forward to seeing all of those other projects and to get to speak to you in a room where we can actually see each other and catch up properly. Congratulations on The Censor and best of luck in all that's ahead of you.
Thanks, Sean. So lovely chatting to you and having me on. I love the show.
Great. Thanks a million, Niamh. Niamh Algar there. And Censor will be in cinemas from August 20th. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena.
The killing moon will come too soon. Fate up against your will, through the thick and thin. He will wait until you give yourself to him.
Will Sargent's signature guitar sound you also heard in McCulloch's soaring tenor voice in The Killing Moon there from Echo and the Bunnymen. And that sound was there from their first chart hit, really, in 1982, the single The Back of Love. They went on to have hits like The Cutter, Bring On the Dancing Horses in the same decade as other great Liverpool bands like The Teardrop Explodes and Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Now Will Sargent has written Bunny Man, a memoir spanning the 1960s and 70s and telling stories from a fairly tough childhood, it has to be said, through to the early days of the band. Peter Murphy has been reading it for us. He's with me in studio this evening. Let's go back to the 1980s and try to define how big a deal would you say Echo and the Bunnymen were back then? Where did they fit in with what was happening, Peter?
If you can take the musicians' ads as some sort of barometer, I recall seeing week in, week out in The Enemy or The Melody Maker, guitarist wanted for band, Into, The Cure, Susie and the Banshees, Echo and the Bunnymen, Joy Division. They were part of a sort of holy quartet of gloomy, intense, serious young men and women. And that was very much the atmosphere of the time. Post-industrial Britain, rain, strikes, Thatcher's government incoming. That was the sound.
Not the happiest place in the world at the time, it has to be said.
Nor is this a particularly happy book.
I mentioned in the introduction there about, you know, the fairly tough childhood. He grew up in the village, Will Sargent, this is, who's given us this memoir, village of Melling. How much does he give us about his childhood growing up?
I could be glib and say far too much, but
thought you might say that right enough.
The book is chiefly his first 15 years, at least half of the book, I would say, is concerned with an extremely grim upbringing, sort of like Angela's Ashes through an amplifier with slightly less rain. A domineering, heavy drinking father, a mother who left when he was 14 or 15, or actually younger, I think. He grew up in an atmosphere of great neglect, fairly serious poverty, bad acne, bad clothes, unwashed, unlooked after, almost Dickensian.
Does he give us any idea as to, does he see that as then feeding into what he did as a musician later on?
There's very little psychological probing or insight in this book, which would be my main issue with it, is that it comes from a school of anti-intellectualism might be a bit strong, but there's a tendency amongst Noel Gallagher, amongst the Stone Roses, amongst Peter Hook from New Order, to sort of shy away from or be embarrassed about any kind of intellectual probing into the music or what's behind it. So you get the obligatory mentions of the Holy Trinity of the 70s of Bowie, the Velvet Underground and Roxy Music. But
so that's the music he was listening to.
Yeah.
Again, does he go into what it was about that music, or did he just say that's what
he
I was
says
listening
it's
to?
Great, and he says I love it. I loved it. But he's far more interesting in brief riffs on visual art. He's far more interesting in the fashion of the time. And there's a lot there's good stuff about this book, and it's particularly good. It's not particularly well written. In fact, I would say it's poorly edited. But the substance of it is valuable in many places. And
yeah,
not
but to be fair, if you're, and I think you've probably said this yourself, if you're looking for a rock biog, you're not saying, right, I want perfect prose here, or I want poetry, although you will get that in some places.
There's a sweet spot, I think. A rock biog shouldn't be, I mean, in certain cases like Brett Anderson's book, Cold Black Mornings, or even Patti Smith's Just Kids, where it attempts to be almost Victorian or Baroque in its prose, it tends to fall flat on its face. And if it's, you know, poorly edited or poorly written, it doesn't satisfy anyone. There's a kind of a sweet spot where I would say, like Mark Lanegan's book, Sing It Backwards and Weep, or even Springsteen's book, Born to Run, or Keith Richards' book was incredibly down to earth, but also powerful. It was good writing.
Of course, writing in a down-to-earth fashion, straightforward fashion, is not an easy thing to do. Sounding normal is not an easy thing to do either.
No.
So let us talk then. You say that there are good parts to this book. Does the childhood bit go on too long?
It does. It goes on for about 180 pages before he even gets to the Club Eric's, which was the hub of the post-punk scene in Liverpool, when he begins to run into glorious characters like Julian Cope from The Teardrop Explodes and Pete Burns from Dead or Alive, or Paul Rutherford, who ended up being in Frankie Goes to Hollywood. And these are incredible characters.
Yeah, so they're the bits that you want to hear, and you want to hear the stories, the anecdotes around those in meetings.
And once it reaches that point, which is almost two-thirds of the way through, the energy picks up and you start to go, well, this is what we came for. And you can feel his excitement as he describes writing about seeing Joy Division in Eric's for the first time. And he actually becomes incredibly articulate in recounting this experience, or seeing Iggy Pop playing to a tiny club. And then, incredibly, he's really vivid on the very first Echo and the Bunnymen performance after he'd met McCulloch. And he met McCulloch, who was a shy, tall, good-looking kid. But incredibly, they'd been playing guitar together for months, but he had never heard McCulloch sing until they got on stage together. McCulloch would not sing during rehearsals, and they played a 12-minute improvisation with a drum machine and incredibly pulled it off.
Wow.
And you can feel a sense of tension and risk and true drama in this section.
Yeah, you see, and even as you describe it there, I feel myself wanting to read that bit rather than the bit that you were kind of yawningly getting through for me to get to the bit that excited you. You also talked about the visual side of things is very strong. And I suppose fashion is particularly important, and the subcultures, skinheads, suede heads, boot boys, there's a whole, normally associated with fashion, there was a look that kind of defined these categories as much as anything else.
Well, there's a truly terrifying sense that emerges out of this book, is that nothing really changed in Britain between 1950 and 1978. That it was still recovering from post-war, you know, bomb damage. So all people had to express themselves through were clothes. But we know about, you know, psychedelia, we know about Bowie, we've heard all about Bowie. But what is very often skipped over, the hidden generation, is number one, you know, the rehabilitation of status quo as a respectable working class blues rock band. Instead of the slightly embarrassing dad rock that they became. And again, the importance of Slade as a pop rock group. And with that, a sense of threat, of violence, and the tribes, the skinheads, the suede heads, the Slade heads, the boot boys, the soul boys, the gang culture, a lot of it influenced by Clockwork Orange. So,
have you a section there that you think that maybe exemplifies where it's at its best then, the
memoir? Yes,
and
it's actually quite dense and no-nonsense and economic, and it shows what
what he can do.
What he can do. So he says, into the late 60s and on into the 70s, Melling would be regularly invaded by Kirkby skinheads. The standard uniform of a skin back then was Dr. Martin's boots, black or cherry red, Ben Sherman shirts, usually a bright gingham check pattern, white or pastel-coloured Oxford style with neat button-down collars, of course, and denim jeans. Levi's and more commonly Wranglers were a staple. Holding their jeans up were thin, clip-on elastic braces, or as they call them in the USA, suspenders.
And you see, and that paints a great picture of the time. But
that actually put the fear in me.
Didn't want to meet one of them yet.
When I remembered what they looked like.
Would Ian McCulloch's story have been more engaging, do you think?
I'm not sure it would have been. He was an incredibly charismatic character, an amazing looking character. Everybody wanted Ian McCulloch's hair, if not his voice. I interviewed him once in the 90s after the Bunnymen reformed. I found him to be completely affable, good company over the phone, but not a particularly visionary, articulate or character.
He did that when he was singing. He didn't need to do it elsewhere.
You know, not to be too harsh, but you listen to Echo and the Bunnymen. I listened to Crocodiles last night. They were a phenomenal band. They don't need to be articulate in any other area than the music.
It's hard not to be cynical about your saying that he takes an awful long time to get going. Two thirds of the book, in fact, but he's clearly where does it stop? He's setting up volume two.
Very evidently setting up for a sequel. It stops like as soon as they are told they put out their first single on Zoo on Records. They get reviews in all the music weeklies, and they sign a deal with Sire Records in the States, and they're told by Seymour Steen of Sire, I'll sign you, but you have to replace the drum machine with a real human being. And it stops there, right when any other decent rock biog should be starting.
You want that to be the end of chapter 2?
Why not? Make one great book instead of eking it out. Yeah.
Will you still seek out volume 2 when it comes?
I actually will, because I think his accounts of the Bunnymen at their most powerful and at their most stratospheric would be a really interesting read.
All right,
but I lay the blame here with the editors, the publishers, that they, my analogy is, they let this man go on stage with an out of tune guitar.
Yeah, or they said to him, please tell us about your childhood, and you know, he gave in and did what they asked. Anyway, we won't know the answers to those questions, but we know how you feel about the book for sure, Peter. Bunnyman, a memoir by Will Sargent, is what Peter Murphy has been talking to us about. It's published by Constable. And so to our album reviews up for consideration this evening, King's Disease 2, the 13th studio album from rapper Nas, follow-up to 2020's King's Disease, which earned him a Grammy. Loving in Stereo comes from British producer duo Jungle. It's the third studio album from the band that had previous hits with Busy Earning and Time. We'll start, however, with the return of one of the biggest rock bands of the last 20 years, The Killers, and their latest album, Pressure Machine. Andrea Cleary and Brian Boyd have been listening. But with Pressure Machine, it's an album that's all about small town life in America, and many of the tracks open with stories from the inhabitants of that town. Here is how the album starts.
All right, well, I'm 26, so I've lived here for 26 years. I married my high school sweetheart, so we've been together 11 years. I don't really travel much, so I've just been here.
I'm busy, John. You'll have to wait. My little brother, he moved into the community, and they tried to tape him to a flagpole or a tree up at the high school. So if you don't fit their mold...
It's just a nice, small community. Everybody knows everybody. Good place to live and to raise kids. We'll be here forever, so yeah, it's a good area.
Well, they bowed their heads on Sunday, cut out through hedges and fields, where the light could place its hands on my head in the West Hills.
West Hills, the title of that opening track from The Killers' new album, Pressure Machine. And as I said, Andrea Cleary and Brian Boyd are our two reviewers on this Friday evening. Andrea, this is certainly a departure from anything by The Killers, really, but certainly from the more stadium-friendly Imploding the Mirage from last year. I suppose it is picking up on a kind of a mood, a global mood from the last 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, I think a lot of artists have kind of gone one of two ways with so-called lockdown records. Either you go the way of kind of Dua Lipa or Roisin Murphy and release these albums of pure pop escapism, or you go that little bit more introspective and reflective. We saw Taylor Swift do that to great effect, and we're seeing that now with The Killers with this album. Very much a concept album, as you said, you know, based in the town of Nephi in Utah, where Brandon Flowers grew up. Based on stories he kind of heard or knew, or you know, sort of urban legends even from around that time in that town that was at that time population, you know, under 6,000,
yeah.
Very, very small. Everybody knows everybody, and you know, you can hear in those clips there, it's the type of place where, you know, people are saying things like "Oh my heck," or saying "We'll be here forever," and that can either be a good thing or a bad thing.
They're
depending on what way you look at
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely, and we got the bit from the guy in the middle there saying like, "Well, if you don't fit the mold, you better watch out." And the other thing about it, Brian, is it talks about all of those aspects of small town America. It also talks about hillbilly heroin, and it paints a very bleak picture. Brandon Flowers, I wonder how the people of his hometown feel about him, Brian.
Yeah, it was very much influenced by John Steinbeck and that sort of Dust Bowl depression, and this idea to get back to what Brandon Flowers would perceive as being real, authentic small town people. And there's a slight patronising tone to it. Mm. We heard there the intro. They have each song, there's a mini audio documentary introduction by people talking. And I'm just wondering, as you were saying, about how those people will feel as being portrayed as being some sort of anthropological freak show. It turns them out, and he portrays the characters. It's very much as he sings in a lower key. He sounds like Bruce Springsteen. On some songs, he sounds like Graham Parsons or Willie Guthrie. It's totally changed around. They're using pedal steel guitars. They're using this haunting harmonica. They're using fiddles. The songs, you cannot dispute the songs. However, there's a lyric on the song Pressure Machine. "I'll get up and cut the grass. Ain't nothing wrong with being working class." I mean, for God's sake, Brandon.
Yeah,
I think there is a sense of patronising gazillionaire rock star looking at ordinary people.
Yeah, there is for sure. And those little vignettes at the beginning kind of emphasise that. It's almost as if the songs grow out of...
It would be interesting to see what the people themselves in this town, how would they react next week when this album is released.
When they hear themselves. Yeah. Let's have a listen to a track further down into the listing here, Runaway Horses, which features Phoebe Bridgers.
Unwavering forces, head first into the unknown. Like runaway horses in a fever till the end. And every step is a silver prayer in the face of a heart.
It's a track called Runaway Horses from The Killers and their new album, Pressure Machine. Andrea, the stories that we're hearing here, none of them are going to surprise us in terms of a tale of small town America.
No, I don't think so. I think especially, you know, small town America in the 1990s, there is very much a through line of the opioid epidemic, which really kind of took hold in this town around that time. There's also some songs about homophobia and the grip of the church on the kind of the moral and social fabric and lives of Americans kind of permeating.
Yeah, great lyric in the final song saying this whole town is tied to the torso of God's mysterious ways.
Absolutely. And there's, you know, there's the more acoustic led song Terrible Thing, which follows the story of a young man who's contemplating taking his life because he is gay. And I think it's quite bleak. You know, it's not, it doesn't let up a whole lot. There's not a whole lot of joy in this album. I don't find it quite as, I suppose it's not my place whether or not I personally find it patronising, but I don't have the same problem with the with the clips from the townspeople as Brian does.
As Brian says, we need to hear what they say absolutely, about that, which is what you're saying. Give it your stars rating then out of five.
Yeah, I think... So, look, some of the imagery is a bit overdone. Wild horses, picket fences, all that kind of stuff I've kind of heard before. But I did really like the snippets of audio and the interviews. And without them, I wouldn't like it as much as I do. So it's 3 stars for me.
3 from you. What are you saying, Brian?
You cannot fault the songs in this album, but too often I was reminded of Bruce Springsteen with a haunting harmonica sound. I was reminded of the River album so many times. So 3.
3 from you as well, Brian. Let's move on then to King's Disease 2, follow up to last year's King's Disease, which won a Grammy for Best Rap Album for Nas. Debut album from Nas, 1994, Illmatic. How important is he in the world of rap?
He's huge, Sean. I mean, there's more marquee names, for example, Kanye West and Jay-Z. But if you look at that debut album, it was actually being inducted into the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry as a significant cultural artifact. He's over since he began really as the archetypal angry young man coming from a very working class area of Queens and singing in that sort of gangster rap idiom we've become. But over the last almost 30 years now, he's evolved into the elder statesman, and he's very much a respected figure. And on this album, you see him almost like becoming like a grandfather type voice. He's very relaxed. He's very chill. He's talking about things he's never talked about before. Contentment. He's dispensing wisdom. This is a very different Nas to the one that emerged talking about street violence and gang warfare.
And he's also talking on this. He's referring specifically back to the East West, that whole feud back in time, and the death of Tupac, Andrea.
Yeah, so there's a track on it called Death Row East, and it's a very, very interesting track. So Nas and Tupac kind of started to knock it along, we'll say, around the release of Nas's second album back in 1996. And they had a clash when Tupac was in New York, and Nas has kind of come out and said now on this track that it was basically all because of a misunderstanding. He says that the two of them were sort of getting ready to patch things up when Tupac was murdered then in 96.
Let's have a listen to Death Row East.
He was a dangerous threat. M.O.B. almost turned half of New York red. Brothers I grew up with threw up their sets. Some even had them death row chains hang off their necks. There's a rumor that spread I like to address. Pac was never set up by Stretch. Let it rest. I stepped to him at Bryant Park so we could speak direct. He didn't disrespect. We plan to reconnect. I flew to Vegas to shoot the Street Dreams video and link with Tupac. Try to squash the East Coast, West Coast beef. We didn't talk, but he was still alive in the hospital. And it rained that day in Vegas. Rest in power.
This is my nigga Nas, and we both got one thing in common. We both represent Queens to the fullest. Alright? This brother was good enough to stop his show, and I want everybody in here, everybody stand up on their feet first and foremost, please. At 7:03 p.m. New York time, 4:03 p.m. Las Vegas time, Tupac Shakur passed away, y'all.
That's an extraordinary moment on that track, that announcement of the death of Tupac Shakur.
Very visceral, yeah. It's very, very chilling. And he does seem to try and draw a line below that whole East Coast, West Coast feud. And that's very much in line with where he is now. I mean, he is late 40s. He can't really be that angry young man again. It was funny, on one of the songs he's talking about working out on his Peloton stationary bike because he has to look after his core. And he also talks about how he has a personal chef, and my chef knows how to cook with no salt and low fat. So this is very much rap going into its golden years. This is the first time really we've seen this sort of almost like retirement rap.
Yeah, but it may be retirement rap. Does the quality of the music still hold up in the midst of all of that, Andrea?
I love the idea of retirement rap, and I really hope that goes ahead. I mean, I think the best moments for me are actually in the production itself. I mean, the songs that go a little bit heavier on loops and samples. There's a looped soul sample on Nas Is Good, which is just gorgeous. Mm. And there's little bits where there's the kind of twinkling piano throughout and some live drums on My Bible. And there's like a church organ, which brings all these really interesting textures together. Piano harmony on the Brunch on Sunday is beautiful and soulful as well. And I think that, you know, he's enlisted the producer Hit-Boy, who produced the last record as well, and this record. And I think the pair really seem to have found a stride musically with each other. Not all the lyrics kind of do it for me here, but I think that when they fall into step with each other on some of those tracks, it works really, really
Stars
well.
Stars from you, Andrea?
Yeah, I think it's the production that elevates this for me. I'm not about to argue that Nas isn't, you know, one of the greatest, but his verses just kind of left me wanting a little bit more. It's another three from me.
Three from you. And Brian?
I think he remains rap royalties, 3.5.
3.5 for retirement rap from Brian Boyd. Let's finally then move on to Jungle, an album called Loving in Stereo. Third album from producer duo Josh Lloyd-Watson and Tom McFarland. Let's listen to a track called Keep Moving. Welcome to Friday Night Fever, is the minute was what I thought the minute I listened to this. The Bee Gees are alive and well and singing in falsetto under the disguise of Jungle, it would seem. Andrea?
Yeah, I mean, this is really, you know, if you don't know Jungle, you probably know them as that band whose songs are on all the ads, and all the songs that are on the ads pretty much sound like this song. So there's one song called Busy Earning, which was the third single from their debut record, and that was heard in everywhere from kind of car ads to broadband ads, and I'm sure everybody's very familiar with it. And this is no different, really. They definitely have a style, and this record isn't much of a deviation. What you hear there is pretty indicative
much from that across the 12 songs. But Brian, this is an album where you want to get out on the dance floor, which unfortunately is very difficult to do at this very moment in time. Does it have anything beyond the, you know, bangers that'll get you out there dancing?
The only dance floor, I mean, the only place that's going to play this awful album is an overpriced Marbella nightclub populated by Russian oligarchs. It's dreadful. The songs go in one ear and out the other. I would actually say, don't buy this album. I can name any amount of Rick James, Sly and the Family Stone, Parliament, Funkadelic albums. These are basically posh white kids imitating funk music.
They kept their name secret for a long time.
They did.
They're
from a very rich background, and they went to a really expensive school. So they only used their initials. They wouldn't appear in their videos, and even their name is designed to put people off on Google search. And it's plundering funk and soul music. I'm putting on this glossary contemporary production, and as Jeremy was saying, they're used all over ads and they're used all over video games. Nobody in the real music world would take this seriously. There's far better stuff. Buy Rick James, buy Sly and the Family Stone. Don't go near this album.
Are you in the same boat then, Andrea?
I'm not. No. I mean, I love disco. I love funk, and I completely understand where you're coming from, Brian. But I think that this is homage. I mean, I can't really say that there's anything too sinister going on here. I think the production is really, really strong on this record. I think that the melodies are there. Like, it makes me want to dance. I'm not really expecting any more from this group, do you know?
Yeah, one critic's homage is another critic's plundering. Well, stars from you, Brian.
I had post-traumatic stress disorder because of the ghost of Jamiroquai. I was raising its head.
Not a good
that
thing.
That awful white boy trying to do black music. Too.
Two from
That's
you,
generous.
Andrea.
Oh, it's 3.5 for
three
me.
And a half
I'm sorry,
out. You
Brian.
Get on the dance floor. Off you go. Enjoy it. If you're going to have to put a disco ball up at home, go with that one. That's Andrea Cleary and Brian Boyd speaking to us this evening about Jungle, Loving in Stereo, Nas, King's Disease 2 and The Killers' Pressure Machine. And that is our lot for this Friday evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan.